I don't know very much about it, but I've got a little glimpse into the emotional situation by having taught at the American University in Beirut during I think I'll start off rather quickly by showing a few of the watercolors I did when I came to, then I'll come to the topic proper. That is Beirut early in the morning. It's right on the Mediterranean. These are perhaps too small for you to see. I can lay them out and let you look at them afterwards if you please. That's early in the morning. The fishermen down on the banks of the Mediterranean. There's no tide in the Mediterranean, by the way. It's delightfully warm. People could swim there in April, and then they could ski within 2 hours by running up to the mountains. That's one of the buildings of the American University, looking up from the Mediterranean down below. It's a very large campus. That's only one of the buildings. The American University is largely supported by foreign aid. Annual giving is between $13 and $14 million from America for the support of that institution. This is up on the hill near the building, looking down toward the Mediterranean, which is a perfectly amazing blue and gets bluer every time I paint it. Getting bluer. This white over here was a tree with a silver bark and no leaves at present, so I just left it white. Now some of these are smaller. That's one of the buildings, and down below is an Arab loading sand on a donkey. That was a bit up country. When I arrived, they had a strike. I was never so honored as to have a whole university on strike when I was announced to lecture. Here was the policeman at the gate. I've labeled that the gate of opportunity at the American University. Down below, a girl studying under a tree. Here's Charles Malik, who is on their faculty. This I've labeled the life strenuous. It's two workmen on the campus just having their morning chat, even without a coffee break. These are characters whom I saw around the streets and so on. The only hippie I saw was a Chinese. The Americans are very careful to see that all of their students are in one room. They don't want to offend Arab taste. And when the boys at the preparatory school came back from vacation, the barber awaited them. I took a 17-year-old grandson with me, and he said, "Grandpa, I haven't seen a woman in slacks yet." I said, "Well, there's one." He said, "Well, that's one." In 3 weeks, I think he saw three. And the men were all carefully groomed. And here are some characters seen on the streets. They wear Oriental costume. One missionary said to me, Lebanon dresses Eastern and thinks Western, and Turkey dresses Western and thinks East at Easter. The Turkish government has a frightful time to bring the villages into line with their Western policy. They compel them to give up the fez and dress Western, but they can't get over Western ideas. But you see the fez in Lebanon rather frequently. This is a picture of a man sitting on a donkey with an enormous load on both sides. I have labeled that, "The balance of power in the Middle East is precarious." Here is the guard at the Museum of Ancient Antiquities, and he is decidedly fed up, rather bored with ancient ceramics. And incidentally, Doctor, this would interest you. I saw a Phoenician skull with a gold wire tooth grates all across the upper level, going clear back to the Phoenicians. Here, a camel and a yellow ochre sheep to match the camel. I don't think a sheep ever get a bath. This is Roman ruins at Byblos. There you'll see the remains of 18 civilizations culminating in orange slacks, worn by a tourist, not by a student at the university. Here's my grandson photographing. He said, "Grandpa, I wasn't photographing that." I said, "Well, never mind, I want to catch you." Up here, the ruins of a Roman temple near Beirut, and the excavators didn't want to destroy the trees, but yet they wanted to get down to the ruins. So they made little walls and little enclaves all around the trees that preserved them. It was like little groves in the middle of it. Down below is the potter at his wheel. 10 years ago, he worked it by a foot travel, but now he's got electricity. This is a bridge at the gap through which all the conquerors came into Lebanon. There is a bas-relief of Sennacherib, an inscription of Alexander, of Napoleon, Allenby, and Eisenhower. The bridge was built by the Ottoman Turks, and through an arch of the bridge you can see Roman aqueduct. Down at the bottom is a caravanserai in ruins. It was a place where the caravans spent the night. And here is a gate of the university. That's a building about 500 years old, used for storage. This is going up into the hill country in Moss. And this again is Roman ruins at Dublis and Roman ruins at Tyre. This is Baalbek, the ruins of the great temple of Zeus put up in the period of the Emperor Hadrian. I saw a group of tourists wandering around, and one man with a rather grizzled beard. I thought he was probably a German professor, so I tried to edge close to him to see what language he was speaking. By chance, we found ourselves shoulder to shoulder underneath alongside the pillars and underneath the great architrave above, and we were looking up at the scroll work, and I heard him exclaim, "Gee willikers." These are Roman ruins at Tyre. Tyre and Sidon. You notice the little strip of the Mediterranean alongside of it. When Alexander besieged Tyre, the people all took refuge on the island. In order to conquer the city, he built a causeway all the way across. It's still there, still used. And this little stretch of the sea alongside of it is so narrow because of what Alexander constructed. Out in front of the island was a breakwater constructed by Hiram of Tyre, the one who sent the cedars of Lebanon to Solomon. And although much of it has crumbled, you can still see some of the stone appearing above the water. And it's a very favorite place for skin divers who go down and bring up artifacts from the Phoenician period. But incidentally, you can find artifacts even on the bathing beach. I was entertained by one professor who had a paperweight. I picked the thing up. It was extremely heavy. I looked at it, and I saw that it was a Phoenician axe head, rusted, of course, and some stone attached to it. He found it just out there in the bay when bathing. I had an interesting time at the point of souvenirs. My grandson, of course, had his own taste in that regard, and he bought a lotus lamp. It was in the shape of a lotus flower, and you turned it down at the bottom, and the leaves opened up, and the lamp was inside. Well, the only difficulty with that, as a relic from Lebanon, was that this lamp was made in India and can be purchased in New York. My taste went for something a little more in the direction of antiquities. I was taken and introduced to the director of the Museum of Antiquities at the University of Beirut. He had a whole tray of duplicate coins, and he sold me 6 or 7 of them for just a pittance. They were just black circles. You could hardly see a thing. He said, "You treat those with caustic soda and wrap them in zinc foil, and you see the images come up." Well, I thought caustic soda was baking soda. It didn't do a thing. But I learned afterwards that he meant lye, so I used Drano. I didn't have any zinc foil, but I rubbed and rubbed and rubbed, and sure enough, here it emerged, the head of an emperor, with the leaves of the chaplet over his head, and a nice little ribbon off for the tail of his hair and behind, and here a Greek inscription around the top, and here was a coin of Sidon, with the bull carrying off Europa. Here was another with an emperor sacrificing, another with the facade of a temple. I got our numismatic expert at home to identify them when I returned. They were all Roman coins of about the second century. Augustus, well, some even went back to the first century. So I got them all cleaned up as well as I could, and then mailed them to my nephew as his souvenir. We have 2 days in Greece. This is a fallen coin in the temple of Zeus, and that raises the interesting question of reconstruction. In some instances, they're reconstructing the way they think things used to be, and with a good deal of freedom. In others, if they've got a fallen column, they put it back up and use a little concrete if some part of what is broken. Or if there's an architrave across the top, they may put across a steel bar and then put on the original stone. And where you've got pieces left, I think it's thoroughly legitimate to reconstruct, indicating what is original and what has been adapted. But when you sort of make a model of the thing on the idea of what you think it ought to be, I think it's going a bit far. This is the Acropolis looking down on the water below, and this one is a boy standing between the pillars of the Parthenon, and this is the fire escape in the building across from the hotel with all the laundry out to dry. I think it makes a nice pattern. And this finally was the Acropolis from various angles and times of the day. We were there on Easter Sunday of the Orthodox calendar. The Easter service was simply superb, but the word of the former premier, Papandreou, was quoted in the papers, who said, "Christ is risen, Greece is dead," referring to the military dictatorship and the number of liberals who were imprisoned on the Greek islands. Well, that is just a little pictorial review of a month, and now to get back to the questions involved. I have a curious little introduction to the feeling between the Arabs and the Israelis through a trivial incident which occurred in the university cafeteria. My grandson and I had most of our meals there, and an Arab checked off the amount that we had spent. In between checking, I noticed that he had a little tiny book in his hands. And after a while, I began to get acquainted with him. I said, "Well, what's that book you've got?" "Oh," he said, "that's Jehovah's book." I said, "Oh, come now. Jehovah's in the Old Testament. That's a big book. You just got a tiny little book. I think you've got the New Testament." "Well," he said, "it's Jehovah's Witness." Jehovah's Witness. And then I learned that the Jehovah's Witnesses are suppressed in Lebanon. He was carrying on surreptitiously. And the reason why they are suppressed is not because of their pacifism, but because Jehovah is Israel's God. The feeling attaches itself even to a word. You don't say Shalom in Lebanon, you say Salam. I had an opportunity of talking with a number of Arabs. One way is just to go around and sit down in front of a sidewalk cafe and pick up a conversation. One man was sitting by himself. I said, "May I join you?" He said, "Oh, yes, indeed." So we just sat and began to talk. He told me he was a Jordanese who had property in Old Jerusalem, which now had been taken over by the Israelis. He said he had written to the new government requesting a certificate of his ownership of a certain piece of property. In reply, he received a document, not in Arabic but in Hebrew, informing him that his property had been sold to an Israeli. I was given a brief printed report of an investigation conducted by two American sociologists who had gone into the Arab refugee camps and had interviewed, I think, something like 1,000 to find out what had been their individual experiences. The general report was that the Israelis had simply bulldozed their houses and told them they had nothing for which to be indemnified. That if shooting occurred in the village, the people would run away until it subsided. When they came back a day later, perhaps, they would have no houses, not because they had been shot up in the fighting, but because they had been deliberately bulldozed immediately in order to put up a housing of the kind that we use in urban developments. And one of my friends who had studied at the Jewish University, the American University in Jerusalem, said he had witnessed this rapid bulldozing. The Israelis and the Arab refugees tell stories of atrocities on both sides. And of course, as far as that's concerned, they may be right. The number of refugees, including those from the June War, something over a year ago, has gone up to about 1,000,000 and 3/4. And they're living in temporary shelters and receiving food from foreign aid, and they've got nothing to do but to breed children. There is great complaint that they ought to be indemnified. After I came home, I read an article which said that the Israelis all along had been ready to grant either indemnification or repatriation. But the Arabs wouldn't accept it because the price would be the recognition of Israel as a sovereign state. But there is the refugee problem. It is a festering sore. I was told that in the refugee camps, one would find very few people between the ages of 20 and 35 because they're all away receiving training as commandos. Their plan is to keep on constant raiding from across the river. So Israel faces a continual insecurity. I spoke of the intensity of feeling, and it's there. It involves the United States. We are held to be supporting Israel. The Arabs claim that they have no good press in this country. They're not allowed to state their case. The feeling is such in Syria that Americans are not admitted at all. I could look over the hills and see where Damascus was, but couldn't get in. When we even approached the border of Israel from Lebanon, our passports were taken up a tire, and we were held under very careful scrutiny until we came back. And automobiles coming back were searched to make sure that they hadn't any bombs in them. So the feeling is very acute. And Syria in particular is frightened, fearful that Israel may extend her boundaries and take over enough of Syria to give her control of the headwaters of the Jordan, which she will then control for her own benefit. But although the feeling is so intense, there are some moderates. In Jerusalem, there is a group of Arabs and Jews who are working for a compromise solution. They put out a paper of which I saw a copy. I'm not sure that it can be obtained directly in this country. One may have to import it through England. I hope to investigate that point. But I read an article in it by an Arab who had been a member of the Jordanian parliament. He said that from his point of view, Israel had no business being there as a national state at all. But she was there. We have, he said, two nationalisms in conflict. the only possible resolution is either war or a compromise agreement. For himself, he said, he would be willing to settle in terms of the line as it was in June before the recent hostilities, recent as of a year ago. He thought that the Arabs would do well to recognize Israel in the back of that line, and if she would retreat to that point and they recognized her, then hostilities could cease.